All right, everybody, welcome to our weekly restaurant webinar. We've given the title this week, Rise to the Occasion. And we'd like to thank everybody, and especially all of our special guests that are joining us today. We're going to have an action-packed program. And our goal here, as always, is to deliver value to you in a short period of time and hopefully give you information, inspiration to carry you through the day and through the week. As you notice, we've been moving around a little bit with the theme and the title for our program. And this week, Rise to the Occasion, I think, really strikes the chord of what we're seeing with all the great leaders on the phone today and listening in on today's webinar. Use the example of Reggie Miller. I don't know if anybody was watching that game back in 1995. I can recall I was. I was bartending at Baja Sharky's, the Sunday shift in Manhattan Beach, and coming off a Thursday, Friday, Saturday close and opening on Sunday, and all of a sudden this game comes on and everybody thinks Indiana's out of it and Indianapolis is out of it. And Reggie Miller obviously did what was the unthinkable that day in, scoring, 8 points in under 10 seconds to bring Indianapolis back to victory, which was pretty amazing in terms of all the clutch performances of all times that I've ever seen. And, kind of feel in some way like the restaurant industry is like Reggie Miller right now. I've never seen, a group that is so strong and so tenacious and does not, give in to lose, that dealing with insurmountable odds that are coming at it in every direction and at every moment, but continuing to persevere and to bounce back. And that's the spirit of the American restaurateur. That's the spirit of the restaurant industry. And that's how we are seeing people come together now, like never before, to get through this together. And odds are pretty steep for a lot of folks, and there's a lot of challenges ahead, obviously. But working together and staying positive and staying strong is the way that we're all going to get through this. And the good news is that there is help out there. There are people in leadership that really want to help. There are lots of other folks outside of government that very much want to help and to save this industry. And it's a matter of figuring out what is the best way to do it in the country, in every state, in every city, coming up with plans and getting out there and executing. And so I'd like to start off today's call by welcoming Mario Del Perro. So Mario is, many of you on this call know and have are familiar with. He and is co-founder of Mendocino Farms. Ellen Chin have been very active in the restaurant leadership space for a long time. And they have Mendocino Farms being one of the top grossing sandwich concepts in the United States. And they have also been very active in the city of Los Angeles in policy and other things for a number of years. They served on Mayor Garcetti's Entrepreneur in Residence program the past couple of years, and wanted Mario to come on to talk about kind of reasons why LA may be a place, to reignite the restaurant revolution. So Mario, welcome.
Riley, I appreciate that. Very, very kind introduction. I probably need you to call my mom after this, and if you could deliver the same thing, would be appreciative.
Happy to do it.
Dude, I got to tell you, I think the biggest thanks needs to go to you, Riley, and your Davis Wright Tremaine team for their leadership and accessibility during this time. I think, really in dark times, you find your true friends, and you guys have been an unbelievable resource. So thank you for doing all that you guys keep doing. And particularly around the city of LA, as much as, I think there's a huge opportunity, and Mayor Garcetti has shown a willingness to listen. As many of the people on the call, which I already want to thank so many of you, we've experienced enormous headwinds from the city council out of the gate, trying to propose a lot of policies and ordinance changes that were actually going to hurt our ability to come back from this. So at this point, though, the mayor and his team are really, really actively engaging with us on creating policies and suggestions that are out of the box and things that they might not have ever really entertained. And so to your theme of, I think you said it was rise to the occasion. You know, I have some real cautious optimism, probably less of a cheerleader with pom-poms and more maybe like the guy with the foam finger. So I do believe that that the city of LA is bigger than just the city, because if bad ideas are set by the city of LA, a lot of cities could adopt them. And likewise, the counter and the optimistic thing is, if the city of LA is willing to take some bold initiatives to help get businesses back on track, then we have a huge opportunity for it to be a beacon for many other cities to adopt similar policies. So if there is any big ask for everyone on the phone, is we really need the continued support. And you know, we have at times called and asked you to step up and take a leadership role in getting some of these proposals either countered or through. And I think that, you know, we're going to continue to need everyone to be called on. And I know you're so busy just trying to either keep the lights on or get ready to turn the lights on. But these policies have a massive impact on our ability to get back on our feet. So just Riley, to kind of jump into, because since you've been kind of the leader, but most of the suggestions that we've been focusing on in the last couple of weeks have really been two-pronged. One is, of course, creating policies that save jobs, and the second being, you know, making sure that that we can suspend or prevent or alter, you know, policies that could adversely affect the restaurant industry. And that's really been a kind of a main focus. Riley, do you want to kind of jump in, or do you want me to kind of discuss some of the things that we have going on?
I think, Mario, some of the things that you and Ellen and the team of restaurants worked on in connection with the Entrepreneur in Residence program, you know, there's a number of things in California, you know, that have, you know, started there and gone to other parts of the country, or things that have made it very difficult for restaurants to operate that can be worked on, you know, to make it easier. You know, one of the main policies, you know, that will stop or you know, prevent litigation against restaurateurs of the type that, you know, has been seen by so many of the class actions that cost so much money to resolve and make it so difficult to conduct business, but also the things on the operational side, you know, two words that have been, you know, not well taken in California or Western states, you know, a tip credit. You know, from your perspective, I mean, is this, you know, possible to push something like this? Because I know you'd worked around that idea with an Entrepreneur in Residence program.
Yeah, I mean, without going into to great detail, but one of the big pieces, you know, it's crazy that, you know, 43 other states, you know, have a tip credit and California doesn't. And if you go back in the history, of which I won't, it's kind of disgusting how it happened and how we don't have one. But one of the issues that we try to address at a city level, because obviously it wasn't a state commissioned office, was how can the city of LA provide a tip credit that both, you know, meets labor's, needs, as well as meeting the needs of the restaurant owner that's living off of such, you know, small margins. So we have suggested some policy that actually allows for a minimum amount achieved through both pay of a base of the state minimum wage, which is actually far lower than the city of LA's minimum wage, and then you actually would have to guarantee, it would be an option for restaurants, but guarantee that they make $20 an hour. As we know, most of our servers, you know, make far more than that in full service restaurants. So that's a fallback point. But as early as this week, we've submitted a proposal to the mayor to actually just ask for a straightforward tip credit. So those of you that are more interested in kind of the fallback policy, I'd love to be able to, you know, feel free to reach out to me, you know, one-on-one. But right now we are proposing to do, you know, to suggest a tip credit for the city of LA. The second thing, though, that I think is really big is permitting and supporting tip pooling for all non-salaried employees. And I know that there's, you know, some of that is possible, but to be able to kind of widen that. Another great suggestion, though, and I've, a lot of you guys have probably dealing with this issue, is some of the team is not wanting to come back right now. And is still being able to collect unemployment. In fact, you know, we need to get them back to work based on a lot of factors, but to potentially offer a hazard pay increase and have that that additional expense or the additional increase in pay be a sales tax credit. So it would be able to be deducted from sales tax. And that was another kind of bold suggestion that has been brought up. But we have had to deal with a few policies in the city of LA that have been and potentially have been extremely adverse, you know, to the industry. I do have to thank everyone that really helped. It was roughly 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, that there was a policy for an additional 2 weeks of paid leave for employees that have been impacted by the COVID-19 virus that the company, in addition to in the city of LA, had to pay. And the city council saw it wise to not have anyone that had under 500 employees have to pay for it. But of course, every business over 500 employees nationwide had to pay for it, which actually impacts probably everyone or most everyone on this phone call that has a number of restaurants in the city of LA. And because of the advocacy of Riley and so many of you, we were able to get the mayor to hold that policy on his desk. So he did not sign. And so that did not become an effective ordinance. So that was a huge minor victory, but at least it kind of set the precedent for city council that this mayor is really trying to do things that are going to help businesses get back to business and get back to hiring. And I think that sent a message greater than even the policy. But we have a lot of other things that are coming down the pipeline that can be massively impactful in a negative way. Forward scheduling, you know, needs to be shelved. We obviously are right now in the city of LA dealing with, you know, rent protection and temporary rent eviction protections, but it does not actually help businesses over 500 employees. So to actually get that amended as well. So there's a lot of things down the hopper. Riley, feel free to add. I mean, you've been working closer to this than anyone.
Well, appreciate it, Mario. And those are all, you know, great things that are being worked on. I think the key here, the big takeaway is, you know, this is a time for restaurateurs to get active and get involved. We're seeing that with the group in LA. We have over 50 groups that have already, you know, jumped on board to support. True to the Hollywood scene, we have a very prominent celebrity spokesperson for this campaign that's going to be announced soon, who is fired up about getting the good word out about saving jobs in restaurants. And not only doing just that, but putting the restaurant industry in a position to emerge better and stronger than ever, because we know that with the right policies, we can create greater access to good food and good jobs for those who need it most. And this is the time to do it. So everybody who's on the call, you know, want your support in LA and beyond, feel free to send your logos, and you know, you can send me an email, if let me know if you're on board here, and we're going to work together as a team, and we're going to get some good policies going, and we're confident about that, because the audience is listening, the time is right, and the restaurant jobs are the most fragile at the moment. They provide the most opportunity for those of all walks in life, income level, at any other industry in the business, and they are the most at risk by far. We've seen the real-time data on this from those that are digging deep into the numbers, and we've got to get everybody back working. There is no margin for error or failure here. We have to get the restaurant workers back. And so appreciate everything you're doing, Mario, and the team, and everybody on the phone. Look forward to having support as we move ahead. So thanks again, Mario.
Thanks, Riley. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Now, I thought it would be really interesting today, as the country's getting back to business in some states, or starting to slowly come back to business, is getting the perspective, one of the leaders of one of the, I think, most dynamic full-service brands in the country, Barcelona. For those of you on the phone that have been to Barcelona, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's really in a very special class of restaurants, and it has emerged, I think, nicely over many years from a smaller emerging brand to something much more significant. Been through a number of significant transactions, operating in 9 states, 4 of which are coming back online to business very, very shortly. So we're fortunate to have CEO of Barcelona, Adam Halberg, here. Adam, welcome.
Thanks, Riley. Good afternoon, everybody.
Adam,
good
got
morning,
quite
depending
a background.
On where you are.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. You've been with the company for, I don't know, what, 12 years now, coming from culinary up through the ranks up to CEO.
Yeah, right around there. I started with Barcelona back in 2008 as the culinary director, overseeing the chef program.
Well, and I think you're in Connecticut personally at the moment, but you have restaurants in a number of states that I mentioned, including Georgia, Texas, Tennessee, Colorado, states that are coming back to business slowly. So how have you been handling sales, up to this point?
You know, we made the same emergency pivot to takeout and in some places delivery that everybody else did. I think it's important to recognize that is going to be more permanent for some people than others. There's some food that just carries better. And at the end of the day, the reason why people choose to patronize different restaurants may be because of the I'm hungry part of my brain. It may be because I'm hungry for this part of my brain. But a lot of people, particularly over the past 10, 20 years, have chosen their restaurants over the type of experience they're going to get and the way that the food and the drink and everything is getting delivered to them and the people who they get to spend time with and what the atmosphere is. So having all of that stripped away, we've been keeping the takeout and keeping the delivery going as a basic revenue stream while we really spend our time sort of plotting out the future for when we do get to reopen the doors.
And as far as, have the sales been what you would expect them to be? Have they grown over the course of the last several weeks?
They have grown. You know, we've had the either good fortune or far ahead insight to base most of our restaurants in heavily residential areas. They're not in city centers. They're not near convention centers and stuff like that. So being baked into people's residential places has made us convenient for people. As they've thought about, venturing out of the house, but not too far out of the house. That being said, again, Barcelona's food does not, is the way that it has historically been put together, naturally translate to takeout and delivery. It doesn't naturally translate to people's brains. So there's definitely been a period of re-education of our guests that this is something that we can offer and we can offer it well.
And now that you, at least in 4 states, it looks like there will be the opportunity to get back to business in some semblance relatively soon. What is that looking like for you?
Yeah, we're being cautious on timing. Just because the governor of Georgia or Texas or Tennessee says that restaurants are allowed to open doesn't necessarily align with when we believe that we should open. And that's for a few different reasons. One is there's an unhealthy stew mixing politics and data and science going on in some of these states. And we want to make sure that we are actually opening at a time that not only is safe, but also that our team working in the restaurant and our guests coming into the restaurant feel like they're coming into some place that is safe to go into. And they're not just expressing the, okay, cool, somebody hit the release button, therefore I get to go out. The other thing we want to be cautious of is again, I think there's a degree to which our guests have been accepting of a pared down takeout experience because they crave certain items. But when they actually come back to the restaurant, I think there's going to be a different level of expectation because what people have always come for has been the experience. People have not typically come to restaurants like Barcelona because they say, gee, I'm hungry or I'm thirsty. Those are needs that are much more easily met other places. They're coming for an experience. And if the experience they get when they're walking in the door to the restaurant again for the first time has the entire service team dressed like they're in a surgical ward, that may not be the experience that they were looking for or hoping for, or that we necessarily want burnt into their brains. So we're being cautious in looking at these different phased opening procedures that different states have, and in some cases, specific municipalities have put together. And we want to peg ourselves to the right phase to open when we can provide the experience that people will enjoy and value out of Barcelona. I don't think there's any award that's going to be given a year from now, 10 years from now, for who opened first. The awards will be given for who opened best and who catered to the needs of their guests as best as possible.
Now we're getting a number of questions here, and anybody you know that's on the phone, you feel free to send those through the Zoom question portal. A lot of those are dealing with the kind of the reentry and what your any plans are, specifically with respect to what servers are going to wear, are they going to be masked and so forth. I think more generally, are you getting, what level of guidance are you getting from states on reopening? Is it sufficient or is it, as confusing as some of the other things going on?
The reopening of restaurants is going to be, unfortunately, as close to chaotic as the closing of restaurants was, where every city, every state, in some cases, specific counties are doing this differently from each other. We're appreciative of states that have gone in on coalitions here in the Northeast, right? Massachusetts through New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut have all sort of bound together to at least attempt some sort of synchronized reopening. And that's going to be a whole lot more helpful as we try to navigate the path for reopening those restaurants. It's going to be harder when, again, Colorado is doing one thing and Tennessee is doing something else and North Carolina is doing something else. The best thing that we can talk about, and I think Mario brought this up with holding up LA as sort of a leader and a thought leader as a city in this, is that hopefully we can be helpful in bringing the best ideas out of the best cities and best states as they're doing their reopenings to the ones that are opening later. And if that means giving restaurants the ability to continue some of the executive orders on retailing alcohol, even if that is in a partitioned portion of the restaurant that allows them to retail bottles of wine. We have obviously have some cities or states where we're allowed to do ready-made cocktails, all the rest. There's so many old blue laws that are still entrapping restaurants in their ability to be profitable. And now is the time in a lot of different ways for us to look at the industry as a whole and all the regulation around it and say, this is a hard reset. And how are we going to effectively enact change on these regulations around alcohol, on regulations around labor management that Mario brought up and others? Now is the time, if ever there was one, to take a deep, deep look and not to make impulsive regulations and impulsive judgments and laws, but to make some really thoughtful changes. And I think we've got enough intelligent and thoughtful leaders in this industry that we can give good advice to the leaders in cities and states and municipalities that'll listen.
You touch on the need or the benefits of uniformity in a situation like this, Adam. And I know we had our landlord-tenant town hall a couple of weeks ago that was, we got good perspective from both sides. I think, where restaurants shake out is that, some model terms on leases could be very helpful so that there's not a one-off ad hoc approach to lease negotiations and that landlords and tenants could get on the same page. I think the overall takeaway was that a percentage rent only phase in at some point would make most sense from the restaurateur perspective. I guess, where are you kind of thinking about your real estate portfolio and what what would make most sense from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, we've been really fortunate at Barcelona that the relationships that we have with our landlords have been solid, and that almost all of them have been really, really thoughtful and collaborative, and recognizing that there is some shared pain and some really shared creative thinking that's going to be required for us all to move forward. Unfortunately, I think the landlords are bound right now by their relationship to their lenders. And there's a lot of lenders that are not going to look as favorably with their terms on leases that are completely based on percentage rent. So there's going to have to be some give on the lender end in order for the landlords to really enact change, and definitely to enact change in a uniform way, as you're describing. What I can say is that the landlords, up until this point, have been really, really helpful and collaborative in thinking about abatement and deferment, and in some cases, percentage rent, at least for what we would call the ramp-up period, whether that's the remainder of this year or the remainder of this year into next year. Whether that becomes status quo for the long term, I think ultimately is going to depend on the banks and the lenders behind them.
Well, and that's great to hear that you're having good communications with your landlords, for sure, Adam. That's heartening for this audience, to say the least. What are some of the things, any adversity brings out the best or worst in folks? And, for here, it's all the best with those that are rising to the occasion. In terms of your business, what are things, that you believe, you are learning now that are going to make Barcelona, stronger for the future?
There's been a lot that's been made about the imbalance in this current state between large, whether they're publicly held or corporately owned, chain restaurants and the smaller independent owner-operator restaurants that have really pushed forward a lot of not only trends, but just, pure innovation in thinking about cooking and cocktail making and service styles and labor management in this industry. And there's a real concern that one will just be better situated financially in order to sort of dominate the conversation going forward. And I think Barcelona in particular lands at a really interesting nexus between the two. We're doing takeout everywhere, but it still, just as we've always done, doesn't mean that the menu in Denver, Colorado is the same as in Nashville, Tennessee, and that's not the same that's in Boston. There are chefs in our restaurant that are producing individual dishes, whether it's fava beans and Serrano ham in one place or asparagus with chimichurri in somewhere else, that have created sort of a diversity and a continuation of the innovation that comes out of the brand. And I think people are going to remain hungry for that. Whatever the restaurants are that don't survive this, there's going to continue to be sort of a hunger for thoughtful innovation and changing menus and rapidly changing menus. That, oftentimes the seasons change faster than the corporate restaurant scene can sort of keep up with. And so there's a nimbleness that we have that we're excited and we think is going to be a real differentiator going forward. I think the same thing applies to the broad pivot that a lot of restaurants are making from dining service or takeout to some version of a retail model. And everybody is sort of hanging their hat on the fact that whether it's groceries or prepared goods or whatever else, that some version of retail is the path forward. And that's going to be the balance on the other end of the scale to make sure that we keep our revenues up. Well, we can't all do retail the same way. We all can't become large grocers and we can't all become viable specialty grocers. So the question is going to become, what is it that each of us does that really differentiates, whether it's on value or variety or the special nature of what's being offered? Because if we all just sort of march off the same cliff, that doesn't do us any good either.
Well, Adam, really appreciate you taking the time to share your experience with us today. And I know there's a bunch of questions coming through here. So, if you have questions for Adam, feel free to send them through the portal. What you and your team are doing is, has been and continues to be a real inspiration. So thank you so much, Adam.
No, whatever we can do, if people want to reach out with individual questions, we're happy to. I think the most optimistic thing about all this is we're still dealing with people, and people are not going to stop wanting to go out and socially engage with each other. They're not going to stop wanting to meet up their old friends. They're not going to stop wanting to meet new friends. They're not going to stop falling in love at different restaurants and different places. Social engagement is going to continue. The question is just how.
Well, and we very much look forward, obviously, to the time when everybody can get back and get into your restaurants and others to continue that social engagement. So thank you so much, Adam, for spending your time. And again, anybody on the phone, send your questions on through. So really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Now we have Naveen Negrani. Naveen, many of you on the call know, Naveen is with Hilco, the real estate division. And there's one person in the country that really has their, finger on the pulse of what's going on with real estate nationally right now. It is Naveen. And also, Naveen's cousin makes the best socks in the world, ZK Negrani socks. I just had to add that because they're amazing socks. I hope Naveen sends me a pair for saying nice things about this. They're amazing. And now they're making designer face masks too. So they are really, really incredible socks. And you know, all that aside, Naveen is incredibly talented with respect to navigating restaurant groups through real estate situations of all types, especially these unprecedented ones like now. So welcome, Naveen.
Yeah, no, pleasure. Can you hear me?
I can, yeah. Great to have you here, Naveen. So
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I know with you have a lot going on, obviously with your day job, but you know, wanted to kind of, you know, get some perspective from you, you know, and share as you see fit, kind of what's going on, what, you know, should the people on the phone be thinking about with respect to their real estate portfolios and these issues?
Yeah, sure. So I'll share some thoughts, and then, you know, just in the spirit of the theme of this town hall, rise to the occasion, as opposed to just focusing on, you know, negotiating super near term with your landlords for rent relief, deferrals, abatement, you know, I'm going to focus more on just broader opportunities and things to just sort of consider. But just to comment on one thing Adam said in terms of falling in love with restaurants, I remember when I met my wife, we met at a restaurant, and I actually used my cousin's socks as sort of like, kind of like a peacock. And, you know, that's what started the conversation. I can't even imagine what it'd be like to go to a restaurant with a mask on and, you know, try to use that. But, you know, I guess this is sort of a new normal that everyone's going to get used to. So we'll see how that plays out. And, you know, Riley, you know, just echo the prior folks talking and just, you know, the industry in general, and just congratulating you and the team at DWT for just your thought leadership and just your ability to bring people together in this community and really just capture the energy of what's going on. And you know, it's been great to work with you and your colleagues as a trusted legal advisor on transactions, but just to super appreciate kind of what you're doing and how you're doing and the general vibe of it. But, you know, as it relates to just kind of the real estate, you know, just zooming out, looking at it from the clouds, you know, our business is one where we've historically been special situation real estate advisors based on events, whether it's like a merger, an acquisition, a leveraged buyout, an activist campaign, or doing work with publicly traded companies, you know, on their portfolio, or in many cases dealing with restructurings and bankruptcies, you know, depending on where we are in the cycle and just the nature of what we're doing, we've been on different ends of the equation. And, you know, quite candidly, what we're seeing today is just unprecedented. You know, to use an analogy, you know, it's still sort of a zoo, but the zoo's turned into a circus where it's the same characters. Everyone's just doing all sorts of weird things. And, you know, we've been trying to react to what's going on. And, you know, for the last 7 or 8 weeks, besides reacting like everyone else, we've been studying the market. You know, in particular, we've been looking at the capital structures of regional and national restaurant chains. You know, there's some visibility, particularly for those that have their equity or debt traded publicly. We think that there's going to be some Darwinism, if you will, you know, strongest will survive. But, you know, any company that was stressed prior to COVID is just going to have further acceleration of their issues in terms of, you know, stores that are losing money on a four-wall basis, the need to potentially restructure. And so, you know, we are studying that. We've also been studying statistical data on the retailers and national restaurant chains that have been paying rent or not paying rent in cases during the months of March and April. We've been studying the state-by-state shelter-in-place orders and trying to get a sense of when the music will come back on. And it's not so much as when the music will come back on, but it's to use an analogy, when people will start coming back to the dance floor and there'll be a general return in terms of traffic in both the restaurants. Certainly, the restaurant industry does not work in a vacuum. There is a correlation with retail, particularly for restaurant chains that are in malls or located near malls. Think of like a casual dining chain that's an hot lot or next to a movie theater. And we're tracking all the retailers that are having some hiccups, and particularly the big box retailers that may end up filing bankruptcy and the resulting impacts that that will have on the traffic in malls. Just trying to get ahead of what will be the new normal. And then I would just say, with the exception of QSR, it's very tough to prognosticate and offer conjecture as to what the landscape will look like in 6 months. I mean, besides just the general makeup of the industry, there's certain markets like Las Vegas, where if you think about what's going on there, even if the stay gets lifted, how long will it take before people start going to conferences, people start going to nightclubs, people start gambling again? So it's hard to provide conjecture with meaningful amount of clarity, other than that we are capturing a lot of data, and every week the picture becomes a little bit clearer, at least in terms of what the pain is. But having said that as a backdrop, I just sketched out three things to think about, across the profile of whether you're a healthy restaurant chain or a stressed restaurant chain or just an operator. I know there's a few hundred folks on the call today. So here are three thoughts just to think about. First, and this isn't super exciting to think about, it's more asset management, but every group out here from an operator perspective should have a strategy in place as it relates to lease renewals. I mean, everyone is focused super near term on the last month, the next month, and the month after, and the return to traffic in their restaurants and what the sales will be. But there should be a strategy in place that every operator has as it relates to dealing with things like, what sort of market landscape will there be when leases coming up for renewal? Are there tenant improvement allowances that you can get from your landlord as an incentive to stay? Are there things that are non-economic in nature, like personal guarantees that you might have on the leases that you could try to shake off, or even certain things like parking and securing additional signage? A lot of these things aren't meaningful on an individual basis, but they all add up. But in particular, we are definitely going to be entering into a soft retail restaurant real estate landscape. And so there should be opportunities to take advantage of that, particularly for lease renewals. The other idea that I have here, sort of a twist on the traditional sale leaseback model. So it's no secret that, many groups, particularly those led by private equity groups, when they're buying a business, doing a leveraged buyout, they unlock value in the real estate via sale leaseback. Well, today, there's probably a very unique opportunity. Now, this doesn't apply in every case if you're in a strip center or in a shopping mall, but if you're a single tenant, let's say casual dining restaurant, there's probably an angle where you could try to, being the tenant leasing the property, where you might be able to negotiate acquiring the dirt in the building to which you occupy. And if you could buy it at a cheap enough basis, knowing that you control the tenancy, you could, when the dust sort of settles on this corona and things sort of come back in 6 months, or you could recast that out to the marketplace and, find a buyer and sort of capture that arbitrage. The other angle there is, there are so many restaurant chains that will likely file for bankruptcy. There'll be opportunities when those restaurant chains go into bankruptcy where they reject their leases. You'll have the opportunity to go in and reverse engineer a conversion to your concept and, acquire that real estate on the cheap. And knowing that you're buying it on a sort of per square foot basis, you can then occupy it. And then, once you have your tenancy in place, go out to the marketplace and sell it. So there's certainly going to be an opportunity to take advantage of the real estate market and capture some, acquisitions where historically that might not have been the case. And then, Riley, and for those on the call, the third idea I have here is more of just a sort of a unique idea that I offer to a friend of mine. I'm an outside of what I do at Hilco, I'm an investor in a restaurant chain. It's a farm to table concept in Chicago. There's four locations. And, you know, in the last several weeks, of talking to the general partner and the operator of the restaurant, it's sort of been like listening to a country song. You know, it's been sad initially in terms of, you know, having to let go of employees, you know, the frustrations of dealing with landlords and insurance claims, frustrations of filling out the PPP paperwork, and then just sort of waiting in line. And the thought I offered to him was, you know, he's got, and his team has an incredible human capital base of talent. You know, they, besides actually having infrastructure and a GMA platform, so like payroll, accounting, legal, HR, IT, you know, all the shared services stuff, he's actually got a great culture. And in this market, knowing that there's going to be a lot of restaurants that end up shutting down and going away, you know, I've asked him to think about putting together like a management services group, which could really leverage the best of his human capital and then be a resource for landlords and constituents that work on transactions where they're dealing with, you know, a restaurant that goes away. And, you know, he's pretty excited about it. You know, he sees this as an opportunity where he can create a lot of fee income and, you know, more importantly, put people back to work and take advantage of sort of what's in front of them and make the best of the situation. So those are just a couple of ideas to think about as we navigate through this. Again, playing into the theme of this town hall of rising to occasion. You know, there's a lot that could be done today, even given the backdrop of the uncertainty of what's going on and when things will resume super near term.
Well, Naveen, really interesting idea about management services agreement. We had noticed a number of developers looking at and actually working off that model before the crisis, where they were looking to fill space. Tenants did not want to go under a traditional lease. So we were seeing, you know, hybrid structures, joint ventures with a manager, management services component with no capital in from the restaurateur, where they're getting paid off the top or the bottom, you know, no personal guarantees on any lease or anything like that. You know, I like the way you're thinking there, because I think, you know, we're going to see a lot more of that as space needs to be filled and landlords are deciding kind of what to do to fill the space while they might be looking for, you know, longer term, you know, tenants under more traditional structures.
So something that just, you know, sort of a string to pull there, but, you know, the art of the conversion is probably going to be one of the things that becomes more topical, particularly given the supply demand imbalance that we're going to be experiencing. So there's ways to take advantage of it without actually thinking about it from a pure financial capital perspective.
Well, Naveen, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you if they want to talk to you about kind of what you do or your perspective?
Yeah, particularly for some of this data that I'm aggregating and just to get some insight, you know, obviously through LinkedIn or, you know, Riley, you've been great. You were one of the first people who reached out to me when all of this sort of chaos started. So, you know, happy to get in touch with anyone through you or through LinkedIn, and certainly happy to share some thoughts for anyone that needs it.
Well, thank you again, Naveen, for sharing your time and expertise. And, you know, anybody on the phone here, if you need, you know, help in this area, Naveen has proven to be one of the most thoughtful and competent and accessible people in the industry and a great supporter of restaurants. So thank you, Naveen. And, you know, everybody out there, VK Negroni socks, they are the best. And not just saying that to try to get a free pair out of Naveen, amazing. And looking forward to face masks as well, but hopefully those will not be in circulation for too long.
Yeah, thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Naveen. All right. Well, you know, I think as all of us are sheltering in place somewhere in the country, a lot of us in locations that are not too exciting or exotic, you know, happy to have our next guest who, you know, has his, what we would call, want to live vicariously through him. You know, and if anybody has ever been to the great state of Hawaii, which I've had the good fortune to on several occasions. Several years ago, I went and I was staying in a place in Maui, and I noticed a restaurant called Monkey Pod Kitchen. And it looked like really cool, like it was built to grow. I mean, it's just a great design and everything else went by. I went inside for dinner and I was blown away at how high quality, the food, the service, and the volume they were handling was absolutely mind-blowing. And then later, the Lonnie Resort Disney opened and visited the one across the street. I don't think I ate at another place for like an entire week. And it turns out it's Chef Peter Merriman. And Merriman's obviously a fine dining restaurant, have been around the islands for a number of years. Some of the most amazing experiences that you can find in Hawaii or anywhere in the country, the beautiful locations and the incredible service and the amazing food. And then you have Monkey Pod Kitchen, which, you know, we see a lot of restaurants all over the place, you know, and in terms of the volume that you do there and the quality that we're able to execute, it's pretty mind-blowing. And so it's great to have you here, Chef Merriman. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks, Riley. Thanks for having me. Aloha, everybody. And thank you for doing these webinars. They're really, really helpful and informative. And I'm really, really happy. Everybody's going to think I'm friends with Naveen or something, but my notes are almost the same as his, and I'm coming from the other side of the equation, being the restaurant operator. You know, to go backwards a little bit, we're totally shut down in Hawaii. Maui County, where I live, we have restaurants on all four islands, but Maui County has the highest unemployment rate in the country right now because we're absolutely dependent on tourism. We don't have military on that's a big alternate business on Oahu, but not on Maui. So we're in the jam, just like everybody else in the country is in the middle of the jam. And I imagine our journey has been that country record, same as yours. First, we focused on PPP and we tried to do takeaway meals and that didn't work. And, you know, and now we're moving into the new phase. And I think our new phase, now that the PPP money is coming and unemployment benefit checks are starting to reach our people, but now we're starting to look at our landlords and our landlord relationships. And the big thing that occurs to me is that it's got to be an education process, because it's the same story for everyone, I think, which is, oh, the landlord has to answer to their lender. So therefore, the landlord's saying, oh, we wanted to defer your rent for the next 2 months. And I'm thinking, you know, hey, deferment doesn't do me any good, because that's like, you know, layaway plan for a new television or something. If you can't afford it now, you can't afford it. And we're not open. We're doing zero. The problem is, I think with our big land, we have like 10 units, and some of them have local landlords and some of them have national landlords. And as Riley pointed out a couple of weeks ago, it's actually the national landlords that are preferable to deal with right now, because I think they understand the situation a little more than the local landlords. But the whole equation of how the restaurant business leases property and then that landlord pays for it, it has to change. And what I'm absolutely certain of, the reason we need to talk about education is that the lender has to understand that the tenant can no longer carry the entire burden. At least in Hawaii, what we've had going on for the past several years is triple net leases, and we pay minimum rents and then we pay percentage rents above that. And then, of course, the CAMs are additional, and some of the landlords have used CAMs as actually a profit mechanism, which we've been able to endure in this boom market for the last several years. But as we move forward, all that has to change, or else a whole lot of us are going to go out of business. And like everybody's pointing out, a whole lot of us are going out of business, but we can do it in a nice fashion, or we can do it in a much rougher fashion. And if we can get everybody to the table, which is those of us who are operators and our landlords and the lenders, then we can share the burden a little bit. We've had some landlords who actually came to us, and we have one landlord that tried to increase our percentage rent through this downturn, tried to get us to assign an extension and increase the amount of rent that we pay, which we found really weird. And we're not going to go along with that, obviously. So I'm really excited to hear Naveen say those types of things. I'm not sure the mechanism that we can use to have that discussion, to talk to landlords and to lenders, but I think it's a really, really important thing that we have in front of us.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Chef. I mean, as we said, our landlord tenant town hall a couple weeks ago, and we'll recirculate that recording. It requires collaboration you know, from tenants to landlords to banks to government, you know, to make something happen here. And I'm serving on a, you know, a small advisory group in a city that includes representatives from, you know, major banks and, you know, a regional bank. You know, and some of the off-the-cuff you know, feedback initially was, well, just go out and apply for the PPP loans, and that should solve right. the problem. And you know, and everything should be all good. And it's obviously right. not the case. And we'll get into kind of, you know, some new information on those PPP loans and the audit response from the government later on this call today. But that's a, you know, it's a great short-term solution for some folks, but it doesn't address the underlying problems that we all know about, especially underlying problems that have existed long before this you know, this crisis hit that need to be addressed now in order for business to stay in business and to move forward. I guess, you know, Shep, some of the things, I mean, your restaurants are so, have such a great vibe, you know, and I think in sales per square foot and the ability to handle the traffic and the quality of the offering and everything else, you know, it's rare that a concept is so, you know, dialed in as you are. I know there's been talk in the past, a lot of requests for Monkey Pod to come to the mainland. Do you see any opportunities potentially coming out of this to take that step into the mainland, or are you fine kind of as is at the moment and playing wait and see?
No, we're going to keep our eyes open, definitely. There's going to, like, as has been pointed out, there's going to be lots of different opportunities. So we're trying to keep our powder dry and make sure we have some cash and ability to borrow at the other end of this. So we were in negotiations on a site on the mainland, and we stopped those for the time being. We're going to have to, you know, actually, to tell you the truth, we're designing two new restaurants in Hawaii right now as we speak as well. And we made the decision to move forward and continue the design, which costs us money, and we're not sure what it's going to be like on the other end. But we don't want to get to the other end of this and not be prepared to deal with a market that does return, if it does return. But you, can I go back to one thing is, the way we do our rent on our P&Ls is we call it occupancy costs. I know a lot of the operators on the call will probably do the same thing. And we take all of our costs that are required by the lease and we put it on a single line item. We call that occupancy costs instead of rent or something like that. And so that would include CAMs and general liabilities and any insurances, et cetera. So we've had success with one of our landlords thus far who we've gone to and said, look, we need to forget about base rent. We forget about percentage rent even. We're going to talk, let's talk about occupancy cost. Because I have small restaurants, some of my restaurants do three times the volume that some of my other restaurants do. So I understand the difference between the large volume restaurants and the smaller volume restaurants. And the weird thing is, it's almost counterintuitive, but the large volume restaurants in percentage cost can handle a higher occupancy cost than the smaller volume restaurants. So we've gone to some of our one landlord thus far, and we're going to go to more, ask for the same, and said this, look, you want us to open, but we don't want to open because there aren't any tourists here. But when we do open, we want to pay zero rent to a certain level. And then from there up, we want to focus on occupancy costs. And it's going to take honesty and complete communication between the two of us and trust. But we're going to pay a very low occupancy cost on the next increment and then step it up as time goes on. And what it does for us is it allows us to break even or be profitable early on. And it gets the landlord at least some cash coming in. And then the lender can feel a little more assured in that situation.
Yeah, and Shep, that is a perspective I think has been shared by some other pretty sophisticated groups out there that, you know, I think hopefully could catch some traction. So really, you know, that sounds like a very, very you know, kind of practical and sensible approach.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't often get called sophisticated, so I'm really excited about that. I appreciate that.
Well, you know, I think as, you know, been given some time obviously to work through this, having the restaurants, you know, closed for a while. I mean, what are there a couple things to share that you think are going to come out of positives as this to share with the audience, you know, to make Merriman's and Monkey Pod stronger?
Well, I think these lease structures are a big part of it because it's been kind of out of balance for a number of years. But there's some other things, some really interesting things that happened. One was we tried the to-go food originally, and some of our guests were, they love our staff so much that they were actually, they'd show up and they'd buy $50 worth of food and they'd leave a $200 tip. And it was all managers working to take away food. So the managers didn't want to keep the tip. So what they did was they pulled all that tip money and they went to small farmers and they bought their produce because the small farmers were stuck with no place to sell their food. And then our managers turned around and organized food distributions for all our employees. And we spread that to all, it eventually spread. We finance it now. We don't rely on tip money anymore because we don't do the takeaway. But we once a week at each of our restaurants, we give a large sack of food, which is like enough for four people for several days. And that's been super beneficial. And the employees really, really appreciate that. So that's one thing that was really nice. Another thing that I think we kind of lucked upon, but it worked very well, was early on, we saw it was a tremendous disaster. And we said, the only way to deal with this is to be transparent and honest throughout. And so we've done that with our employees. We communicate with them every week at the very least, if not more often, and tell them what's going on, actual decisions that we're trying to make and so forth. But one thing that occurred, which was kind of unusual, was the Department of Health in the county of Maui came out and said, that, oh, there's a large restaurant on Maui that has 65 cases of coronavirus. And the reporters started calling us and saying, hey, we heard you're the guys. We said, we're not the guys. And it turns out we were the guys, but it wasn't true. The Department of Health had their facts wrong. And so our CEO, Christina Schenck, she came out right away and it was kind of like the Tylenol defense, if you will, if anybody's old enough to remember that from 1982. She came out right away in the newspaper and said, look, here's what we had. We had three cases. Here's what we did. Here's what we enclosed and gave all the statistics. It was, you know, it was full kimono, and it's been super beneficial to have done that. The mayor came out in the front page of the paper and thanked us for having been so forthcoming with the truth. And we're thinking that this is going to be an important model for all restaurants as we move forward, because when we do start to get our restaurants reopened, how do people know which restaurants are safe to go to? And one of the things we learned when this false report came out was people were calling us and saying, why don't you have it on your website? And our thing was, well, it's not going to make sense for every restaurant to have to list their corona contacts on their website. And probably the government is not going to be able to solve this issue for us, to be a central aggregate for this type of information. And so that's possibly another area the restaurant industry can band together and figure out a method, whether it's via the software on the mobile phones or how we do it, to say, be able to hang a shield on the front door of your restaurant and say, we're honest and we're clean. You can feel safe when you're coming here. I think that's an area for opportunity. I don't have it figured out yet, but that's one place we can really see going. And if I have another, do I have another second, Ryan?
Okay.
Well, you know, having paid the small farmers and kept them in business a little while, now they're able to shift their markets, so they'll be fine from here on in. But it really made it occur to us is that the purveyors in general, our payables are quite high right now. And I imagine many people on this call are sitting on really high APs. And so the government doesn't seem to be looking at all at purveyors, and purveyors are going to just get burned in this situation, I think. And for us, we have really high APs. And when we reopen, usually when we open a restaurant, I think like everybody, we do it with debt. And part of the debt is covered by the purveyors giving us 30-day terms on our loans. Well, we're going to open day one with already massive APs. And I can't expect the purveyors to carry that load. So I'm really hoping that somewhere down the road, Congress or someone will come around and figure out a method to backstop purveyors and small farmers and other providers as well.
Well, excellent point, Chef. That is indeed the case. And, you know, there's a lot of groups in the chain of this that are, you know, all part of the same situation that need to be taken care of for sure, you know, which goes to the kind of key message of collaboration and working together to get through this. And you know, I wanted to thank you, Chef, for taking time today to be with us. Obviously, everybody on the call, once it is all clear to return to the Aloha State, do yourself a favor and visit Merriman's Restaurants and Monkey Pond Kitchen and all the other great restaurants in Hawaii, because it is a cherished and outstanding restaurant community. And thank you, Chef, for all that you and your team are doing for restaurants in Hawaii, and hoping you come to the mainland soon.
Thank you, Red.
All right, thank you, Chef. And now what's been on a lot of folks' mind, especially as they start to reopen, is insurance and what will be covered, what will be excluded. As we all know, insurance carriers have been busy for many years, including now, drafting around things in their policies to not have to pay on claims, business interruption, and what have you. And so we're coming to a landscape where a lot of you are, and everybody is concerned about what happens, if an employee gets sick, or what happens if a customer claims to have been sick by a restaurant, or conditions at a restaurant. And so we have Zach Cooperman, who leads the National Restaurant Practice Group at HUB, who I know works with many on the call here. And Zach has a national practice. He lived in LA for a long time and relocated to beautiful Austin, Texas, which is set to reopen later this week with to some degree. So Zach, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Riley. I appreciate the time on the call today, and I feel like I'm echoing a common theme, but all you do and all Davis DWT does as a resource to people, not just the restaurant partners, but to the other vendors like us as well, is greatly appreciated. I really see three key areas to discuss, and I'm going to start with business income, and it dovetails quite nicely what the chef just talked about in terms of paying purveyors and other folks in your supply chain. Here's the hard facts. At HUB, we have now filed 4,000 loss of business income claims, 4,000 separate loss of business income claims. And as of this morning, we do not have a single carrier agreeing that they owe loss of business income to any of those claims. Now, they haven't all been resolved. About 50% we have declinations on, but the other 50%, no one has stepped forward to say, yes, there's coverage. And there's an enormous amount of litigation, threatened litigation, lobbying going on around it now. I've listened to a lot of the calls. I've spoken to a number of the attorneys. And, if you look at the largest group, the big group that's, got Chef Keller and Chef Puck and a couple others behind it, their goal is government intervention. The threat of litigation is a component to that, but they're trying to compel the insurance company to come to the table with them and lobby Congress to say, hey, look, we need help. We need a bailout in the form that an airline would need a bailout. Our industry needs that to pay for these claims. Last time I checked, there were about five or six different competing relief type packages that included insurance and loss of business income in them. One was the idea of a pandemic relief or pandemic insurance relief act, PREA, which is modeled after TRIA, which is terrorism coverage, which you've been paying for. There's another one now that's just the, Relief Act that doesn't involve the word insurance that could be administered by FEMA, as scary of a thought as that is. I've seen another one that would just be a straight insurance relief, a restaurant relief bailout for $330 billion. We just don't know how it plays out from here. Obviously, the carriers are going to fight this tooth and nail, and I'm not going to go into the numbers, but it would collapse the insurance industry. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but we just don't know right now. We definitely have not seen anything paid out. Most certainly we would need the government to backstop the insurance industry if that happens. And there's a lot of different lobbyists getting very rich right now, pushing the agenda to see which way this shakes out. Hopefully it comes sooner rather than later. I'm happy to answer any questions on BI in the Q&A as well, but I want to go on to a couple other issues, which I think we're all about to face. The first one is COVID-19 related liability, both from a workers' compensation perspective, an employee perspective, and then secondly, from a guest perspective. Right now, the governor of California is deciding to issue an executive action that would make all essential workers, would give them the right to workers' compensation relief in the event they got COVID-19, regardless of where the cause was, whether it was if they're a hospital worker, whether they got it at the hospital, if they're a nurse, a restaurant worker, a food delivery person, whatever it is, regardless of what it is, they would automatically get workers' compensation relief. That is concerning to us, regardless of cause. The states that are considering right now are 12 states: Illinois, Alaska, Wisconsin, Minnesota, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Utah, Connecticut, Kansas, Florida, in addition to California. So 13 states. I encourage you to lean on your representatives and your local restaurant associations to not allow that automatic guarantee. I'll give you some perspective on what that would mean. Right now, just in California, we think that it would be $2.2 billion to $33.6 billion a year in COVID-19 workers' compensation claims cost if they allow this. So somewhere, let's just pick a midpoint of $11 billion. If they did that, that is 60% of all workers' compensation claims cost right now. So right now, they spend about $20 billion in workers' compensation claims costs in California. If they allow this to go this way, then it would go from 20 to around $32 billion right off the top, which would immediately translate into higher premiums next year. So that's our current concern. Now, if an employee does get sick and we do think it's related to work, they can't sue you, there's workers' compensation coverage for this, and we should be okay. The other topic I want to quickly address is general liability. As we start to open, guests may allege that they got COVID-19 in one of your restaurants. If that's the case, most likely your general liability policy will cover you. The caveat is the virus exclusion. Now, whereas in business income and property policies, where that's the way the carriers have been declining coverage, and that's almost in 95% of all the policies out there, virus exclusion is not in 95% of general liability policies. It's in a very small portion of those, less than 20%. So if you do not have a virus exclusion, and a guest alleges that they contracted COVID-19, your general liability carriers will defend you, and they will pay claims in the event it's somehow proven. We think the burden of proof on the part of the plaintiffs here will be very high to say that they ate in your restaurant and lived in this world for 14 days, but specifically got it at your restaurant. We think that burden is going to be very tough, but you will not have to defend that claim. Your carrier will be there for you as long as there's not a virus exclusion. The only other thing Riley, anything else to address specific to this? Otherwise, I have one other point.
No, I think that's great, Zach.
So the only other thing I would say, and it's slightly dovetails off what some of the folks have said, you know, one of the things about running a national practice is you probably talk to 10 to 15 clients a day. What's going on? What are your challenges? What are you thinking about reopening? And one of the things we decided to do a little while ago was partner with another firm, Results Through Strategy. Some of you may know them, and build a guide towards reopening. All the practices that we've reassembled from different people and talking and hearing people like Chef Adam talk about, we're doing this or we're doing that. We've just taken all those conversations, tried to organize them into nice silos. So instead of getting an article with one or two points, you'll have a guide with 60 or 70 points that addresses everything across the restaurant. It has templates in there, a customer protection promise if you want to put it in the window with your logo on it or customize it. It has template communications you may make to the press, to your employees, to guests, to whatever it is. And we're actually releasing that tonight. It also has links to resources. You know, Riley's in there as a resource. Now, everyone on this call knows Riley and can reach out to them, but there's other people that are of value that you may think, oh, I really need this. I need a deep cleaner in this state right now. And in theory, it would be in there for you. So definitely be on the lookout for that document. It will come out tonight. It's in the form of an ebook, and it has some VO in it as well. So with that, that's all I have, Riley, unless you have any other questions.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Zach. And to the extent anybody has questions for Zach, shoot them over through the question portal on Zoom. And, you know, I think a takeaway from this is, you know, check with your broker and make sure you understand your policy before resuming business. Or if you're in business, make sure you understand it so you're not caught by surprise. And obviously with the workers' comp issue, you know, be thinking about that and be able to support, you know, initiatives to make sure that, you know, things don't happen in a way that cause, you know, greater harm to you and your business. Because, you know, things are moving very quickly. And Zach, as you said, there's a lot of lobbying pressure being placed in various directions all over the place. And, you know, we're going to see, you know, how things work out very, very soon here. So sitting back and not being involved, you know, is a general through line to this whole conversation today, you know, is not the option. The option is to get active, get involved, and you know, get things to the right place. So, Zach, if they want to get a hold of you just through Hub Insurance, want to give your contact info?
Yeah, my office number is 310-902-0722, and then my name is Zach, Z-A-C-H dot Cooperman, K-U-P-E-R-M-A-N. At hubinternational.com or of course through you.
Well, thank you so much, Zach, for spending the time with us, and you know, hoping you're able to venture out into the restaurants in Austin this week as they reopen. You know,
oh, yeah, I'm going to race right out.
And so, and so, well, at least be ordering to go and support the Austin community as I know you are. So thank you. Thank you so much, Zach. Really, really appreciate it. As we have a few minutes to wind up here, I wanted to touch on a couple of important updates on the legal side. And on the finance side, many of you have applied to receive PPP loans or are in the process of doing such at the moment. You know, there was a notice that came out today with respect to audits. And Liz, are you here with us?
Yes, I'm on.
That was not happy news for a lot of folks. So maybe kind of give an idea of what we're looking at here in terms of the $2 million audit threshold.
Sure. So just kind of give a kind of an overview of a couple things over the last couple weeks, mainly as pertains to increased scrutiny on the PPP loans. As you all know, that Congress passed the bill last week for an additional $310 billion of funding for PPP loans. And yesterday, lenders began processing the applications. And not unexpectedly, there were tons of issues, including the SBA portal crashing. The SBA has said as of yesterday afternoon that there are double the number of users accessing the system compared to any day during the initial round. So they expect the funds to be depleted much quicker than the first round. In light of, you know, the high demand and limited supply of PPP funds, you know, has resulted in scrutiny and criticism of the PPP loan program. It seems like every day there's a new company on the, you know, in the news that, you know, has gotten funds and people now think that they shouldn't have. In response to the public backlash, the Treasury and the SBA over the last few days have taken measures to tighten or clarify eligibility rules. In particular, at the end of last week, they issued an FAQ and an interim final rule providing guidance on eligibility. As a part of everyone's application, they've made the certification that economic uncertainty made the loan request necessary to support the ongoing operations of the borrower. You know, this was one of the certifications amongst many that was part of the application. And as no specific metric or standards have been communicated as to what, you know, is required by the certification, it had been made fairly freely by many borrowers. And at the end of the last week, the SBA has made clear that the certification is not to be taken lightly and in fact may be closely reviewed. They have stated that borrowers must make a reasonable good faith determination of necessity And in doing so, they must assess their ability to access other sources of liquidity sufficient to support their ongoing operations in a manner that is not significantly detrimental to the business. Now, it's not clear what this requires. The SBA has indicated that public companies with substantial market value and access to capital markets will most likely not be able to make this certification in good faith. However, there's, you know, a lot of companies that, you know, it's less clear, and it's not clear how the SBA will come out. To add further pressure on recipients to evaluate whether they should have taken the loans, the SBA has provided a safe harbor under which borrowers who already received funds may return the money by May 7th, and if they do so, there'll be no liability. It will be treated as if they had received the funds having made a good faith certification. Adding to this, as Riley mentioned, this morning the Treasury Secretary announced that the government will perform a full audit on any company that received a PPP loan greater than $2 million. And this audit will take place before forgiveness is given. And the SBA has said that they will check that the borrowers who took these large loans properly certified that it was needed in light of the coronavirus outbreak. You know, Mnuchin went further to warn of criminal liability for companies who made this certification, and if it's determined that certification was not true. So kind of given this guidance, I think everyone is wondering what is required to make the necessity certification in good faith. And while it's not clear, it seems to be fact specific, borrowers should consider taking measures that may help if there was a review of the necessary certification. And I think more, the closer, I think the facts, the closer your case is, the more measures you should probably take. You know, the SBA has said that borrowers should consider alternate sources of liquidity to the extent they didn't in connection with their initial PPP application. And if other sources are available, they should consider whether the capital is available on terms or in a manner that is not significantly detrimental to the business. It seems like factors that you should be able to consider would be likelihood of closing, timing concerns, impact on employees, or you know, suspension of business that would be required, the terms of any financing agreements, as well as dilutive effects of equity arrangements, and you know, other factors such as these. Borrowers should substantiate the financial damage their business suffered as a result of the coronavirus and the economic uncertainty surrounding it. Doing that by, you know, maybe documenting estimate of losses, comparison against past years, you know, especially if there's substantiation that shows, you know, reduced need for workers, but getting PPP funds will prevent such cutbacks to headcount or, you know, salary wage levels, supply chain issues, additional operating expenses that the business is having to take into account in response to the virus. In general, just maintain any documentation demonstrating that you meet the eligibility criteria in supporting the necessity certification. Just in general, as more and more guidance seems to be coming out on a day-to-day basis, you know, we caution just to be on the side, conservative side, especially if there's ambiguity. And be careful with any kind of public disclosures or statements to avoid comments that, you know, looking back could reflect poorly on the need for loan funds or the use of loan funds. Because you should, you know, should operate under the assumption, it seems now, that, you know, a watchdog organization is likely going to look into the identity and the details of recipients of PPP loans. And the larger the loan, the more scrutiny that will follow. Just a couple other items to note on the PPP front. We're still waiting for forgiveness guidance. You know, we had thought, based on what was said in the CARES Act, that guidance would be issued by yesterday. And there hasn't been much on forgiveness outside of a couple questions here or there in the FAQs, they're regularly updated. So that's an area that we're still going to be, you know, looking for, hopefully, some strong guidance on.
Well, thank you, Liz. And I think to everybody on the call, the message is, it's always discomforting when rules are implemented after the game has been played, but that is the case here. And so, for those that have taken funds or are planning on it, taking proper procedures to ensure, that you are looking at this at the way that, the auditors are, in, especially with any company consents that are required. If you have other alternative funding sources available, if you're private equity backed or have other, availability to funds, really, taking a careful look at that and how that might factor into some audit and review of any funds received, and also, understanding the safe harbor that's been provided May 7th. If you decide that, if you've received funds, then it would be better to return them to be able to do so. So our team here, obviously Liz and others on the team, are able, willing to assist with anything needed in this department. And thank you, Liz, for the update.
No problem. In addition, they actually, as applies to portfolio companies, the SBA has said, portfolio companies are eligible, but they should be especially careful in reviewing the necessity certification, which suggests that, portfolio companies will likely be looked at a little more closely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're just seeing a national kind of, obviously the press is playing a role here in, making companies look like they did something wrong for looking for these loans when, all the guidance was it was perfectly acceptable and these were, the parties that were, should be entitled to receive them. But we're seeing, the backlash and the according response from government. So area to be very, very careful and thoughtful as this plays out. Well, as we wind up here, we'd like to, there's been a few people updates and employment related items going on in various parts of the country. A couple of the most concerning ones we're seeing, start to play out in New York and Los Angeles, and we'll see these in other parts of the country as folks start to rehire. As we said in previous webinars, getting your document onboarding package together, using at-will employment agreements with class action waivers and arbitration clauses. Our team is obviously happy to help with any of those if you're not using those already, because that can save you a tremendous amount of money and headache if you don't already have those. But Roy, I know the Just Cause ordinance is under consideration in New York, getting a lot of press. There's something similar going on in LA that we'll hear about in a second. But what's going on in New York with Just Cause?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Riley. So just last week, the New York City Council introduced a series of bills in response to the COVID-19 crisis that it's dubbed the New York City Essential Workers Bill of Rights. I'll talk about two of those bills today. The first is Just Cause Discharge rules, and it only applies to essential employers, which the restaurant industry is in New York deemed an essential employer. So what the bill says, and what would become law if it's eventually passed and signed by the mayor, it would prohibit an employer operating an essential business from discharging employees without just cause, so long as the employee has been employed for 30 days or more. And what's really significant, I think, is that the term discharge includes not only a termination, it also includes an indefinite suspension, which may or may not be a furlough. And it also includes a reduction of hours of at least 15% of the employee's work schedule. So it's a pretty broad definition of what constitutes a discharge and whether an employer would have to have just cause for terminating the employee. So it begs the question, what is just cause? So just cause is also a fairly broad definition in the bill. It's defined as sufficient cause for discharging an essential employee, such as the employee's failure to satisfactorily perform job duties or misconduct that's demonstrably and materially harmful to the essential employer's business. Notably, the bill is silent as to whether it includes economic circumstances that would justify a just cause discharge. And really significantly, before you can get to a just cause discharge, an essential business would have to demonstrate that it used a progressive discipline procedure. And it would not be able to rely solely on discipline issued in the previous, more than a year before the termination. So unless the misconduct is very severe, it's going to be difficult for an essential business, if this bill is passed, to fire employees in New York City. Again, this bill has been sent to committee, and you know there's various revisions that could be made to the bill. Right now, it contains an administrative framework for prosecuting and defending claims, and it shifts the burden. So the burden now would be on the employer to prove that the discharge was for just cause, whereas under the current rules in which an employee could sue for discrimination, the employee bears the burden of proof. So the second, yeah. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, I say, you know, in similar, I know Janet wants to jump in here at this at the moment, because LA is doing something very similar, looking at something. The city council has passed it with some proposed amendments. It has not been signed by the mayor. You know, it's pending for further review from the city attorney. But, you know, these types of ordinances would, you know, turn at-will employment on its head. And it would basically make it nearly impossible to, you know, fire somebody without facing, you know, serious financial repercussions.
Was that a cue for me, Riley?
That's a cue for you, Janet.
Oh, okay. All right.
New York
okay.
and LA, pretty similar. It's not good, is it?
So it's not good. It's not quite the same here. So the city council has introduced three now, but it looks like two basic changes in the city ordinance. And so one is the right of recall ordinance, and the other is a worker retention ordinance. And this right of recall ordinance, which is now in drafting by the city attorney, and it hasn't been signed by the mayor, but the mayor has expressed interest and support for the concept. So, but right now, this is a bill that would require people to be rehired if they were laid off after March 4th, to be rehired in the order of seniority by position. And so it would apply to all employees with 6 months or more of service. And at this point, it applies to businesses that earn in excess of $5 million, but we don't know where that's going to land. And we don't know if it's going to be narrowed, but the intent is to cover hospitality workers. And so we don't know if that will be narrowed for restaurants or what exactly that definition is, but we'll see. So rehiring in seniority order, unless there is sort of the same just cause to not rehire in the seniority order. And so the just cause standard is going to come into play when you want to skip over somebody and you don't want to hire the person who's been around the longest. And the disturbing thing about this ordinance is it comes with a private right of action, which provides, among other things, reinstatement and rehiring, but also attorney's fees and punitive damages. And so so stay tuned. I mean, this needs to be fixed. It's really a terrible thing for business. The second ordinance is relating to restaurants that change hands or transfer, and basically it requires the rehiring of all of the employees who were working there before and their retention for 90 days, and then subject to a similar sort of seniority type layoff if you want to lay any of them off and not keep them. But the both of these are kind of ill-defined. They're really going to be difficult to administer. The right of recall ordinance, for example, says you need to recall people. And if you could retrain them with the same training you would give to somebody new, you've got to give the training instead. So the whole mess is going to be very, very difficult. Now, I know that Riley has been very active with the mayor and working toward not jumping into any of these crazy ordinances without modification, and that Mario and his group are also working with the mayor. And so we're hopeful that we'll see some changes before this is actually signed into law, but it's a really disturbing standard, and the punitive damages element of it is also very disturbing. And just a quick note, I listened to the not this past one, but the prior debate amongst the city council members on things like this punitive damage issue, and they basically said, hey, this is not a problem. If people get sued, they can just show up in court and show that they had good reason to terminate someone. It just demonstrated a complete lack of any idea about what that means to get sued and hire a lawyer and spend your money defending a lawsuit over something as simple as, I wanted to hire my best worker and this wasn't my best worker that I wanted to bring back. So that's where we are now. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you so much, Janet. Roy, you were finishing up on the second point in New York?
Yeah, just quickly, because I know we're running short, is the other bill that's important for us for essential employers. This would apply to a large essential employer that has more than 100 employees. So there would be shift premiums under this law, where it would be a $30 shift premium of a shift of less than 4 hours, a $60 shift premium if the shift is between 4 and 8 hours, and then a $75 shift premium if the shift is greater than 8 hours. So, you know, we're going to keep an eye out on these bills, because I think it's going to be important for businesses to understand the economics behind opening up and having employees work longer shifts if these shift premiums come in.
Yeah, and thank you, Roy. And I think from what you and Janet said, all of these ordinances, although well-intended by those that are trying to propose them, they're at odds with reality. And they're, in effect, going to put lots of groups out of business and require, and make businesses decide it's not worth it to step back in and to fund an opening just to face a class action lawsuit or an unviable economic situation. So this is the time, to get involved and to rally behind common sense and good business practices, especially in New York and Los Angeles, where what happens there often makes its way to other parts of the country. So thank you, Janet, Roy, and Jillian. I know you had a quick note on kind of the discrimination and anti-discrimination and rehiring. I know people are getting ramped up, and what should they be thinking about?
Sure. Thanks, Riley. Yeah, just for folks on the phone who may not have employees in those jurisdictions that Roy and Janet just spoke about, it's still important that you think through your selection process. I think most of everyone is going to be bringing people back on slowly. They're not in a position to bring everybody back on. So it's important to remember that decision about picking this employee over that employee, an employee in every jurisdiction can sue you for if they think that decision was based on some sort of discriminatory factor. So be thinking about what that selection process is going to be. Even if it's not seniority, it may be performance issues or other factors. It's important that you have some of those factors documented, that you have performance issues documented, so that if that decision does get challenged, you're able to defend that decision with some contemporaneous documentation. And then once you do kind of get it, it may be asking your managers to identify just at first sort of the positions and functions that they need back immediately, numbers of bodies immediately, and then what are those non-discriminatory factors that we're going to look at. And then once you get that body of employees that you're going to invite back first, still take a look at it, because despite your best efforts to base those decisions on non-discriminatory factors, it may just be that you've selected, just all the young white males as opposed to other diverse folks. Perhaps you've recalled, or you're planning on recalling, every server except the three that happened to bring forward harassment complaints last year. Those kinds of factors can certainly open you up to liability. So be thinking through that selection process now. And as always, I'm happy to talk about it with anybody who has questions.
Well, thank you so much, Jillian, and appreciate everybody on the call today. I know we went a little over time, but we had a lot to get through. So thank you for being with us today. To the extent any of you need help with anything, we at DWT are obviously happy to do it to help get through this, and want to really thank our special guests that have appeared today, for sharing their time and their expertise. And so in closing, we're wishing everybody and their families and teams health and wellness. And we will talk to you on our webinar next Tuesday. Feel free to send any ideas or webinar topics that you would like. And we will try to, you know, put together another compelling agenda. So thank you, everybody. And we will talk to you next week.